So, welcome everybody to this, the final session of this weekend retreat, if we can glorify it with the name of a retreat, on the 7-point training of the mind tradition from Atisha as explicated by Geshe Chikawa. Can I ask first, how many people here, pardon me, let me restart. For how many people here is this the first session of this particular set of teachings that you've attended? This is the first one. Okay. So, I think it's going to be okay for people who are new, right? But you do realize that we've had Friday evening, Saturday morning, and Saturday afternoon already. So there's certain material that we have covered, at least to some extent. And so it may turn out that there are certain things that you may not have the background in that you would have had you been here from the beginning. But as it turns out, the material that I wanted to focus on today is, even though it's an integral part of the whole teaching, it, in a sense, forms a separate part. It is something that can be taught more or less separately. So hopefully it will be comfortable for you, even though this is the first of this particular session you've attended. Okay? But having said that, if I'm explaining something and it seems like I'm taking some bit of knowledge or a meaning of a word or term as if I'm taking it for granted, but is new to you or confusing to you, please feel free to raise your hand and ask me to give a little explanation of that, because the main thing is to try to convey this material in a way that makes some sense, that actually does communicate to us. So if there's some, you know, obvious pieces that are missing and a little explanation could smooth it over for you, please don't hesitate to ask. And don't think, well, I'm asking a question that everybody else here already knows the answer to, so it's going to be boring for them. That's never the case, right? Some people say, I have a question, but it's really a stupid question. It's really simple. And my reaction is, great, stupid questions are the best. They're the ones that everybody likes, because it really gets to the, you know, the basis. There is no stupid question. It really gets to the basic heart of the matter, usually, these types of questions. So please feel free. I definitely welcome that. Having said that, I thought I would start by just going over the outline of this basic text. And if you have the handout, the cover says a few introductory notes on mind training. If you have that, then the material that I'm talking about now is on page 4, the abbreviated outline of Geshe Chikawa's 7-point mind training. And after we look at that, then the particular section of the teachings that I want to concentrate on is on the next page, page 5. But we'll start with the outline on page 4. But before we go into anything, it is always an excellent idea to regenerate as beneficial and as altruistic a motivation for this activity that we're all participating in here. Of course, I'm doing most of the talking, you're doing most of the listening, but we're all participating together. We're all trying to focus on an understanding, meaning of this text. But then the question is why, right? So it's not simply to acquire some knowledge, though acquiring knowledge is a good thing, right? It's not simply to become familiar with material that we may not have been familiar with before, Well, that's also a good thing. But it's to derive some benefit, really some benefit, and benefit not just for ourselves, but for others. So we can generate a motivation, both for me as the main speaker and for you as the main listeners, but for all of us as the participants, we can generate a motivation that by participating in this activity together, some benefit is found that enables us to live our life in what we feel is to be a better way, a more fulfilling way, to reduce the causes of dissatisfaction and suffering for ourselves, to find a way to diminish and eventually eliminate the disturbing delusions such as hatred, jealousy, and the like, which plague our existence, and avoid the negative karma which brings suffering in its wake, to experience liberation from all of that, and even beyond that, to cultivate the positive qualities on the path to full enlightenment so that we can bring infinite benefit to all beings. So if we can cultivate the motivation of participating in this teaching situation with that kind of altruistic intention, that will increase the strength and the value and the purpose of anything that we undergo here. Okay? So, this 7-point mind training, as it's outlined on page 4, is one of the earliest and one of the most popular of all the texts in the tradition known as mind training or thought transformation. Does anybody here, just out of curiosity, does anyone here know what the Tibetan for the term mind training or thought transformation is? Because very often it's referred to it by the Tibetan and not by the English. Yeah. Lojong. This is not something that you have to know, right? Because this isn't a language class, and I wouldn't be the one to teach a language class. But it's helpful because when we read different texts, very often the English that's used to translate something changes from text to text. They don't always use the same terms. That's the nature of translation. If you have a feeling for what the original term was, like the Sanskrit term from India, for example, or the Tibetan term, because this is a text in the Tibetan tradition, then even if the English translation varies, you still know they're talking about the same thing. So here it's Lojong, and Lo refers to the mind or thought, and Jung sometimes can mean training, like training the mind, or it can mean transformation, transforming the thought. And so this 7-point mind training is one of the key fountainheads of the Lojong tradition, which goes back 1,000 years in this form. It actually goes back 2,500 years, because all of these are based on the teachings of the Buddha himself and all the great masters who followed, for example, Nagarjuna and Shantideva and so forth. But this particular way of organizing this material, that goes back about 1,000 years. So, and the main emphasis when they talk about mind training is the cultivation of a particular attitude of mind, a particular motivation known that Lama Zopa very, very often calls the precious bodhicitta, the precious compassionate bodhicitta. Now, that term bodhicitta we've talked about several times over the last few days, but very likely there's among the new people here, that might be a new term. Okay? So how would we how would we explain what bodhicitta is? And maybe I'll call on someone who has been here for the last few days to explain it. So that would be kind of a good exercise for us. So if you had to explain to someone else who never heard the term bodhicitta what bodhicitta meant, because that's the particular attitude that's the focus of these teachings, how would you explain it? What does it mean? Anyone? And don't be shy. You know, I might hit you if it's wrong, but I'm not that strong, so it probably was not going to hurt. Yes, please.
The wish to become enlightened for the benefit of all.
Right. The wish to become enlightened, and to become enlightened means to attain the same state as Shakyamuni Buddha, a state of mind which is completely free of all delusions, limitations, and so forth, and has fully developed all positive qualities, loving-kindness, compassion, wisdom, the ability to help others, all of these. That state of mind, which is completely purified on one hand and fully developed on the other, can be referred to as Buddhahood, awakening, or enlightenment. So in the term bodhicitta, the first syllables, bodhi, refers to that state, refers to that experience. And it's also good for some people may not fully recognize, we have the tendency of talking about Buddha in the singular, you know, the Buddha who lived 2,500 years ago. But according to the Buddhist teachings, we all have the potential to experience that same state of enlightenment, right? In a sense, we could say it's our birthright for all beings. It's the fulfillment of our highest potential. So while there is the historical Buddha who lived 2,500 years ago, who originally gave these teachings, there have been many, many other Buddhas who appeared before, during, and after the time of the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, who's represented in the statue behind me. And here in this room are a group of us who have the potential for experiencing that same enlightenment. Okay? So in the term bodhicitta, the bodhi refers to the goal, the attainment of enlightenment. Right? And citta is just the attitude that wishes to attain that goal, that's directed to attain that goal. There have been some people who have freely translated bodhicitta in quite a nice way. It's not a literal translation, but it's quite a sweet translation. They call it the dedicated heart. The dedicated heart. So here, heart is equivalent to mind or motivation or meaning or wish or aspiration. So it's the heart. And is dedicated to attaining this state of enlightenment, right? But that's only half the dedication. I've heard an explanation that His Holiness the Dalai Lama has given, where bodhicitta is a mind, it's a two-pointed mind. It aims for two directions at the same time. Okay, one is the attainment of enlightenment. But there's another part of the dedication that's not specifically mentioned, but is the most integral part of it. How do you have a feeling for what the other thing that the bodhicitta mind is dedicated to? It's dedicated to the attainment of enlightenment, but what else?
To benefit all
beings, right? Right? And in fact, the attainment of enlightenment is like the means, the real end, the real goal is the benefit of all beings. Okay? So attain enlightenment for the sake of benefiting all sentient beings. And I just want to share you an analogy that Lama Yeshe gave. And I think he used this particular analogy because he had been traveling in the West maybe for the first time, and it was the first time he had an experience with the particular kind of a restaurant, which when you go into it, and you go to one station, and you tell them what you want to order, and they produce a chit, a little piece of paper, which has the price of what that's going to cost, and then you pay this person, and then you take the chit and you take it over to the next station, and that's where you actually get the food, right? So Lama Yeshe says, you didn't really go to the restaurant in order to buy the chit, right? Your real intention was to get the food, right? But without buying the chit first, you can't get the food, right? So you have to do one before the other. So bodhicitta is like that. There's the wish to attain enlightenment, but that's not the final goal, my attainment of enlightenment. That's the means for the ultimate goal, which is, universal benefit, as much benefit as possible for as many beings as possible. That's the food. That's what we're looking for. Okay. Another way of expressing the same idea is that through these practices, we are fulfilling two sets of aims, right? We're fulfilling our own aim, fulfilling our own highest potential. That's the attainment of enlightenment. And we're fulfilling the aims of other beings, because what they want is happiness. And by our attaining this state of enlightenment, we're in the best possible position to help them on their path to their spiritual goal. So we're fulfilling those aims, the aims of self and the aim of other. And I should interject here at this point, we shouldn't get the idea that until we reach enlightenment, there's no way of helping others. That would be a mistaken view. In fact, the moment that we take an interest in following a spiritual path, even before we've really cultivated the bodhicitta, just having the admiration for it, just the wish to emulate the practices of someone, a bodhisattva who has that bodhicitta motivation, from that point, if not earlier, we're already benefiting others simply by our dedication to the spiritual path. It's true we can't benefit them as much as a fully awakened Buddha, but it doesn't mean that we can't benefit them at all. That's just not true. So we shouldn't think that this is a path of putting off for the future an activity that we can't do now, right? It enables us to transform all our activities now into a path that leads ultimately to the benefit of all beings. Okay. So it's a very, very, it's said to be a very, very, powerful path in that respect, that even before it's perfected, even when we're just starting to get acquainted with it, we're beginning the process of transformation which will bring about the ultimate aim. Okay. One other thing to mention about lojong, or thought transformation, is that if you want to talk about the Buddha Dharma, Buddhism in general, all the many, many hundreds and hundreds of teachings that the Buddha and the great masters who followed gave, if you wanted to talk about the essence of all of them, well, actually, all of it is mind transformation, mind training, thought transformation. There's no element of it which doesn't either directly or indirectly involve training of the mind. Because as Buddha himself said, if we speak or act with a pure mind, happiness follows. If we think or act with an impure mind, suffering follows. And the Buddha's purpose for giving teachings was to allow us to avoid unnecessary suffering and to experience every measure of happiness and fulfillment. So all of that is done through cultivating the mind, developing the mind, training the mind. Then you might say, well, then why is lojong special? If all of Buddhism is lojong, if all of it is mind training, then is this something separate? Is this something special? because that term Lojong is only used for this particular type of teaching. It isn't used as a synonym for all of the Buddha's teaching. Okay? So it could be, because all of it is mind training. So the reason why this is kind of a special section or quality of the Buddha's teachings is that here, of all the many things that are developed along the spiritual path, it's the cultivation of this bodhicitta motivation in particular that's the main emphasis, the main focal point of these Lojong teachings. So all of these are about enhancing this particular motivation and fulfilling it. Whereas there are other Buddhist teachings, levels of motivation, which come prior to the bodhicitta, right? And those are also mind training, but they're not the central practice of the Lojong. They are the support or the foundation for the Lojong, but the actual practice is this compassionate, the cultivation of this compassionate bodhicitta motivation. And as I said very briefly, the person who has such a motivation is called a bodhisattva. So the Lojong specifically is relating to the spiritual path of a bodhisattva. But not all spiritual trainees, not all Buddhists are at the present moment focused on emulating the path of a bodhisattva. They might be more focused on winning one's own cessation of suffering. Okay? And maybe the motivation doesn't go any further than that, at least for the time being. So that itself is a precursor to the bodhisattva path, but it's not the essential element of the bodhisattva path itself. The bodhisattva path is totally based on this cultivation of this altruistic intention to reach enlightenment for the sake of others, and the Lojong is focusing on that. Okay? So, in terms of the 7 points that this text presents these Lojong trainings in, we can say a few words about each just to give an idea of the general outline, and then we can turn to the specific section that we'll focus on. Okay. So as you see on page 4, it starts off with the preliminary practices. Nagi, you don't have a copy of this?
I left it in my other bag.
I think we have more here.
Okay.
Don will get it for you. But you did pick up this little booklet.
Yeah, this one?
Yeah, yeah. Because did anyone else pick up this little booklet? Yeah, this larger one is something I prepared for before I came here. But this one is something that was printed out here. And it contains basically the same material. I haven't looked to see, looking at it, it's divided into 7 parts, but the 7s don't have a heading. Their only heading is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, okay? So the difference is that here, they're numbered 1 to 7, but each of those numbers has its own heading. So number 1 is preliminary practice, okay? So the preliminary practices are those aspects of the spiritual path that serve as the foundation for the Lojong training. Right? What is necessary to cultivate on the way to developing this altruistic mind or intention of bodhicitta. And it starts with the preliminary, you know, it's called the preliminary practices, but that term, preliminary, can be slightly misleading, even though it's accurate. It can be slightly misleading because some people feel that the practices that are contained in this first section is something you do beforehand, right? But then when you start showing interest in the actual cultivation of the bodhicitta, you leave that behind and you switch your focus to the cultivation of that altruistic intention, right? So it's something that comes before. It's like someone's following a curriculum of math. Once they've done the foundation of arithmetic, they don't have to go back and study arithmetic anymore. They can move on to algebra and geometry and calculus and the like, right? But it's not quite like that. It's more like the fact that even when someone has, using the mathematician analogy again, someone has trained originally in arithmetic, even when they're dealing with geometry and algebra and calculus and the like, they're still using the skills they developed through the arithmetic methods to be able to do those higher practices. Well, this is exactly analogous to this. We don't leave behind these preliminary practices. It's not something we do and then we've gotten over that, we've mastered that, and then we move on to something else. It's something which is perpetually there. We're constantly deepening it, you know. But initially, when we engage in these preliminary practices, we're doing it with one set of motivation, and just to abbreviate it, we could say we're doing these practices in order to escape from the syndrome of unsatisfactory existence, that we want liberation from karma and delusion. We want to get out of suffering. And for that reason, we focus on these four and the other topics related to them. Whereas when we are cultivating the bodhicitta motivation, we don't leave these four behind, but now we bring a much vaster motivation to its study and its practice. Because now we're not just doing it just for ourselves. We're not just doing it so that I can escape from my suffering. We're doing it so that I can help all beings escape from their suffering. Does that make sense? Okay. By the way, in some contexts, instead of calling it the preliminary practices, they call it the preparatory practices. But that comes to the same point, and the same commentary relates to that. Okay. So, within the teachings of the preliminary practices, there are four sets of contemplations which set the basis for this lojung, for this thought transformation practice to take place. And they're often known by these abbreviated subtitles: the precious human form, sometimes called the precious human rebirth, okay? Death and impermanence, action or karma, action. Oh, that was a mistake. Actually, it should have been actions. Actions, karma, and their result, and the faults of cyclic existence. Okay, or the faults meaning the unsatisfactory nature of ordinary mundane existence. Okay. So here I'm going to have to be more disciplined than I usually am, because I want to say just a few words about each of these four, but each of these can be an entire meditation course, right? So I'm going to try to rein myself in from being too talkative about it, but I do want to say enough to show how it forms the foundation for these practices, because it's like if you're going to build a house, you might have really great ideas for what the house should look like, but if you don't spend a good amount of time and of thought and energy in making sure that the foundation is firm, whatever you build on top of it is going to topple. Right? So similarly, these four should be cultivated to an extent that it will provide a firm foundation, not for its own practice, but for the practices of cultivating the precious bodhicitta. So the precious human form. All these titles are abbreviations, right? So what the practice means is recognizing the opportunity we have now, because the fact that we have a human body and a healthy mind, and that we're living in an environment which is supportive of spiritual practice, and all these other ancillary supports allow us to really take advantage of our situation, to do something with it. And one of the ways you can think of how important it is to have a healthy body and mind and live in a culture which is not which supports spiritual practice is to think of the people in the world, just to give an example, the people in the world who don't have the physical or mental facilities for engaging in spiritual practice, right? There are people who have some internal or external hindrance which prevents them to do anything but merely survive. You know, the idea of flourishing is beyond them because it's just enough to stay alive. You know, people who have to work from sunrise to sunset with back-breaking labor, or those who live in an environment in which spiritual practice is illegal, or you can be locked up, you can be executed for engaging in it, means that they don't have freedom. They're human beings, right? But they don't have the freedom of what's called the precious human form, right? They have the body of a human, but they don't have all the freedoms and endowments of the human form. But if we find ourselves living in a society which allows spiritual practice, where there are teachers available who can teach us that practice, where we have the kind of mental capacity in which we can actually study and benefit from those practices, that we're not completely demented, you know, or handicapped in some way that prevents it, when we have all those facilities, this is a rare and special opportunity. If you think that there's 7 billion people on this planet, 7 billion human beings, not all have what we call the precious human rebirth, because some lack the leisure and the opportunity to take advantage of the human form. But we have that. And then, on top of that, there's a lot of beings on the planet who don't even have the human form. You know, they're born as one of the animals, for example. Even a very, very intelligent animal, there's a limit to how much benefit that animal can engage in that lifetime. Maybe through the influence of a very kind teacher, that that animal could be learned to bark a mantra or something, right? Or circumambulate a stupa. But actually to study a text on emptiness is beyond the capacity of even the most intelligent of animals. So it's not as if they're completely bereft of intelligence, that they have no good qualities. Some have amazing qualities. You know, there's many stories that appear on YouTube all the time of animals helping animals from another species, you know, saving their lives, you know, helping them. So there's incredible possibilities, but compared to what's available to us with this precious human rebirth, it's very limited. So now that we have this form, it behooves us to take advantage of it, not to just fritter it away and then at the end of our life feel that we didn't take advantage of having it. Okay, so that's a very, very tiny taste of the kind of contemplations that go into the first of these preliminary practices, recognizing this rare and precious opportunity we have to practice, to cultivate the mind. Okay, the second one follows immediately from that. It's a recognition of death and impermanence, because even though we have a precious human rebirth, this form which allows us to engage in all sorts of practices which otherwise would be impossible, even though we have it, we don't know how long we have it for. You know, it could be gone tomorrow. Even the most long-lived of us humans only live a few more years past 100, right? And most of us, statistically speaking, don't live past the 70s. So sooner or later, this precious opportunity is going to be lost. So a meditation on death and impermanence gives us the idea that not only should we use this opportunity to understand the nature of the mind and cultivate it and generate all of these positive, excellent qualities, but we should do it now because we don't know how much longer we're going to have it. So it gives some urgency to the situation. Okay. Again, a very, very short way of referring to the kinds of contemplations that come under this second subheading. Then the third one, actions and their result, or karma, this is just simply talking a very simple way of abbreviating one of the basic aspects of the Buddhist teachings, and that is that the activities that we engage in have consequences. And if the activities are based on a wholesome mind, right, those consequences are what we want. Experiences of happiness, well-being, peace of mind, flourishing, and so forth. But if those actions are based on deluded, mistaken, harmful states of mind, it brings suffering, suffering that none of us want. Okay? So when one of the basic, not requirements, but kind of commitments for training the mind is to learn the difference between which actions are wholesome and should be practiced and which are harmful because they lead to future negative, unwanted results of suffering and are to be avoided. So in the third subheading, actions and their result, much focus is on gaining a deeper and deeper understanding of what is proper, beneficial, helpful behavior, and which is to be followed, leading to positive results, and what are the negative actions that should be avoided. So that topic, all of these topics, as I indicated, are very, very big, but that one, karma, is a huge topic with many, many ways of approaching it and understanding it, many, many things to cultivate. And then finally, the last one, the faults of cyclic existence, or the shortcomings of our ordinary existence, this is pointing to the fact that as long as we were under the sway of the delusions and the negative karma meaning those actions which bring suffering as a result, as long as we're under the sway of these karma and delusions, then we are trapped in a syndrome known as cyclic existence or samsara. Right? This is a state of recurring dissatisfaction. And that when we're in the faults of when we're trapped in samsara, and of course samsara is not a place, you know, it's the syndrome of the mind itself. So when our mind is under the control of these negative forces, karma and delusions, then we may temporarily experience pleasure. We may temporarily experience moments of happiness and well-being, but those quickly fade and turn into their opposite. So cyclic existence as a whole can be divided into those realms that have relatively more and relatively less suffering. So the human realm, compared to some of the other realms that we could be born in, has relatively less suffering, but even in the human realm, even in the actions which give momentary pleasure, there's no final satisfaction to be experienced as long as our mind is under the sway of karma and delusion. So by focusing on the faults of cyclic existence, which comes to be the faults of karma and delusion, by focusing on that it urges us to gain a complete liberation from this syndrome, to win release from this cycle of recurring misery. Okay. So up to this point, nothing has been said about the bodhicitta, right? We're mainly focusing on my being caught up in this rat race of cyclic existence, and even the good aspects of it are, in final analysis, unsatisfying, right? And eventually we wish to get liberated from that, to remove the causes of samsara from our heart, from our mind, and experience that liberation or nirvana. Okay? However, a very significant shift in our attention happens when we recognize that just as I am dissatisfied with samsaric existence, being under the control of the delusions that arise in my mind and the negative karma that these delusions cause me to create and the suffering that comes inevitably when I engage in harmful actions, just as all of that's true for myself, and just as I wish to experience peace and happiness and a sense of well-being, the same is exactly true for all other beings. You know? So within the scope of the preliminary practices, we're focusing on something we have to focus, our own situation and our desire to break free from its limitations. Without that, there's no spiritual progress. So it's absolutely necessary. But at some point in our training, hopefully earlier than later, but certainly better late than never, right? We start to expand the scope. You know, we stop being so, I think the word is solipsistic, you know, where we think the world is just my thoughts and my wishes. So, you know, if I work for the sake of myself, that's all that I have to do, because everything outside that is just a projection, and the only thing that's real is me and my world. Right, that's kind of a solipsistic trap that many of us fall into. Okay, but at a certain point, we recognize that we're not alone on this planet. You know, we're surrounded by many, many countless beings who have the same exact desire to experience happiness, peace, and well-being, and to get rid of their suffering and dissatisfaction. And as has been pointed out many times, but it's worth being pointed out many, many, many times, is that not only are our aspirations the same as the aspirations of others, wishing happiness, wanting to avoid suffering, but our lives and their lives are completely intertwined, interdependent. Without others, we couldn't exist, we couldn't survive, right? And so, I've quoted His Holiness the Dalai Lama before on this, that as His Holiness the Dalai Lama often says, we can view it that we're all members of the same family. You know, that the beings around us are not irrelevant to our life, they're absolutely vital to our survival and our thriving. And therefore, our intention, our wishes, should not be limited to experiencing my happiness and getting over my suffering, but becomes universal. Their intention starts to encompass the welfare of all beings. And it's with that that we start to take interest in the so-called bodhisattva path, the path of someone who has cultivated this bodhicitta motivation to win spiritual awakening, not in order to buy a chit, right? Not in order to buy a piece of paper, because you can't eat that, you know, but to actually get the food. In other words, to win enlightenment for the sake of benefiting others. So then all of the elements that follow from that preliminary practice then is under the scope of this wider intention. Okay? Now, does that more or less make sense? Yeah? Is there anything about it that maybe is still a little bit muddy, that my explanation was not clear, or maybe my explanation was so redundant that you're tired of hearing it? No? It's okay? All right. Okay. So, now, the second subdivision is called the main practice. And as you might guess from the introduction, The main practice is cultivating bodhicitta. Okay, so we've done what's necessary to serve as a foundation for it, and now the bodhicitta itself becomes the main focus of the practice. And in this case, as you can see from the outline itself, there are two types of meditation, two types of bodhicitta to be developed. And in this particular outline, the ultimate bodhicitta, the ultimate awakening mind, is mentioned first, and the conventional second. That's not always true. The text has it in this order, but many great teachers, when they teach it, instead of starting with the ultimate awakening mind, they start with the conventional one. And certainly that was the main way that I received teachings when I was first studying in India. So what's the difference between the ultimate and the conventional bodhicitta? Okay. Well, everything I've been saying up to this point about what bodhicitta is, you know, the wish to attain enlightenment for the sake of benefiting others, that wish, that compassionate wish, all of that is the conventional awakening mind. That's the conventional bodhicitta. Okay? So we don't need more, we need more practice on that, but we don't need more explanation, because it's everything that falls under the heading of attaining enlightenment for the sake of benefiting others, that compassionate wish. So if that's the case, then what is the ultimate awakening mind? It has to be something different, otherwise it would be a subcategory of the conventional awakening mind, but it isn't. It's something different, something beyond that. So what is the meaning of the ultimate awakening mind? So this is using the term bodhicitta in a way which is a bit different now. Do you have any feeling? And don't worry, I mean, if you give a guess, you know, if it's based on what you think it might be, that's really helpful, because if it's right, that's great. And if it's not quite right, then at least we know what to build on. You know, we know what misconception to remove. Did you want to hazard a guess?
Could it be about discovering the true nature of reality?
Okay. Can you just repeat it, because it's
yes.
Yeah.
Could it be about
you can just repeat the word
unlocking the true
nature
of reality.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it. That's a very good way of putting it. Discerning the way things actually exist, the true nature of reality. Okay? In other words, if the first one, if the conventional bodhicitta is the heart or the mind or the intention filled with this compassionate wish to help, right? We can call that compassionate method. Then the ultimate awakening mind is wisdom. It's the wisdom of such a mind. Wisdom meaning its ability to discern the difference between the way things actually exist and the way we mistakenly project them to exist, So here, the ultimate awakening mind is called ultimate because it's discerning the ultimate nature of things. Instead of being satisfied with how things appear to us, because as the teachings discuss, the way things appear to the ordinary mind has a fundamental flaw in it. It's mistaken. And it's that flaw, it's that mistaken belief in how things are appearing to us that becomes the root cause of all suffering. Okay? So if we want to get rid of suffering for ourselves and others, we have to be able to cut through with the sharp sword of wisdom all these mistaken views and see things as they actually exist, see their ultimate nature. So that wisdom on the mind of a bodhisattva is called the ultimate awakening mind, or the ultimate bodhicitta. Naga, I think you wanted to add something?
Yes. I think it's a wrong concept to have that bodhicittas are only the monks or who went on a spiritual path. I think even like regular beings, like a mom or a teacher, father, whoever is making it work for other people, I think they're already in the world, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Just to repeat, Nag was bringing up the point that maybe I've been giving the impression that the spiritual path is limited to those people who are ordained, you know, like monks and nuns. But that's not at all the intention. One can be on a spiritual path, whether one's ordained or not, whether one's wearing the robes of a monk or not, whether one is ostensibly following this religion or that religion. Being on a spiritual path just means looking into the nature of the mind, recognizing the difference between what elements of our mind or our heart are harmful and destructive for ourselves and others, and making an effort to reduce those, and on the other hand, discerning those qualities which are beneficial and working to increase them, accentuate them. So in that case, like when the example that Naka used was, let's say, a parent, a mother, for example. You know, mothers are, broadly speaking, though there unfortunately are some exceptions, mothers are prime examples of an act of selfless giving, where for the sake of the child, the mother will do almost anything. And so that attitude of selfless giving is very much at the heart of the bodhisattva path, of the spiritual path. So we shouldn't think that when they make the distinction between a spiritual path and a mundane path, that spiritual is restricted to a certain lifestyle. It's an attitude of whether we're tied to the ordinary appearances of things and activities which are incapable of giving us lasting satisfaction, or whether we're really trying to find a way out of suffering for ourselves and for others, and that would be the spiritual path. Okay. All right. So of the two, the conventional awakening mind is that wish to attain enlightenment. And there are different traditions, different approaches for cultivating this conventional mind, this wish to attain enlightenment for the sake of benefiting others. And again, as is true for virtually everything on this outline, a course on the cultivation of the of even one of these, just the conventional bodhicitta or the ultimate bodhicitta, a course on any of those can be very, very expensive. You get an idea. I mean, Shanti Deva's text is how to cultivate, you know, most of the chapters are how to cultivate the conventional bodhicitta, conventional awakening mind. And then there's one, the longest chapter, is how to cultivate the awakening bodhicitta. So you have a volume like this, which is totally dedicated to enhancing these two types of bodhicitta. So it's a very, very, and this is just one text. There are other even longer ones on this subject matter. So it's a big topic, and as I indicated, there are different methods for cultivating the conventional bodhicitta. One of the approaches is called, and I don't want to go into too much detail, but just maybe it's helpful to become a little bit familiar with the general outline of it as a basis for future study or to make sense out of past studies that you've done. One of the approaches is sometimes called the six causes and the one effect. The six causes and the one effect. And this approach starts with a recognition of the incredible benefit that we've received from each and every being, especially when they were our mother. Because from this point of view, our lifetime is not a singular event, but we've been born and reborn many, many, many times, enough times so that all other beings at one time or another must have been our mother. And anyway, it's very beneficial to view other beings in this respect. And then we start thinking of all the selfless kindness we've received from our mother, and recognize, well, we've received that from everyone else. You know, we've been cared for with such tender nurturing by all other beings, you know, at some time or the other. And the more we contemplate that and the following meditations, the more we generate this sense of incredible gratitude and the wish to return that kindness. And so thoughts of loving kindness and compassion towards all beings start to grow. And then we ask ourselves, well, what can I do to repay this infinite kindness that I've received? Right? You know, what can I do to my mother? What can I give to my mothers? Not just my mother in this lifetime, but all beings under the view of them having given us a mother's tender care. And so we can think of all the ways that we can help beings, but in fact, all the methods except one only provide temporary benefit. I mean, it's still valuable, giving food, giving clothing, giving all these elements. It's very helpful. It's very praiseworthy. But unless we're able to lead them along the path to their own spiritual evolution, their liberation and their enlightenment, then we're just basically helping them in the short term. You know, you can feed people excellent, nutritious food, and that's a very, very praiseworthy activity, extremely praiseworthy. Our lamas engage in it all the time, especially Lama Zopa is always providing food on a massive level to many beings around the world. But if that's as far as it goes, then what's it doing? It's just keeping people alive a little bit longer. Right? But if it's combined with the wish for them to be able to use that energy and health to follow the spiritual path, and if we're providing them the means to follow that spiritual path, then we're giving them really great benefit. Because it's not just benefiting this life, it's benefiting the whole continuity of future lives. Right? And the whole scope of this life. Right? So when the trainee in this method of cultivating the bodhicitta really generates this, the recognition that all beings have been as kind as a mother to him or to her, and gets this so strong that the overwhelming wish is to provide benefit back to all beings for the kindness that was received, then on the basis of that, a superior intention, that's what it's often called, a superior intention arises that I must provide ultimate benefit to these beings. I must be able to help lead them on the path fulfilling their enlightened potential. That's the only way that I can fully repay the kindness I've received. And on that, and then once that comes, once that thought, that superior intention comes up, then the question is, well, who can I emulate? Who can lead beings on the spiritual path to liberation and enlightenment? Who is that? What kind of being is that? And we recognize, well, it's only a fully enlightened being can do that. Only someone who's fully purified all the negativities from his or her mind and developed all positive qualities. In other words, an enlightened being, you know, to use a technical term, a Buddha, a fully awakened being. And so, from this series of contemplations comes a strong determination, that's what I must do. I must achieve a full awakening in order to be able to bring maximum benefit to all my many mothers. And sometimes they even use that phrase in the text. Sentient beings, other beings, aren't just called sentient beings or other beings. They're actually called mother sentient beings, viewing beings as, you know, as being as kind to us as our own mother. And of course, sometimes it becomes problematic because some people are brought up in such dysfunctional families that they don't remember having received any kindness from their mother. Then they have to use the kindness of their father or their uncle or their aunt as an initial example. But just speaking very generally, then of course life is given to us by the mother, so it's an ultimate act of kindness. So one of the techniques for cultivating this precious bodhicitta, this six causes and one results, progresses along in this manner. You know, recognizing all beings having been our mother, remembering the kindness, wishing to repay the kindness, cultivating love and compassion, the superior intention, and then finally the bodhicitta. So it's a stage-by-stage process. And you can very, very profitably spend a long time, I mean, not just hours or days or weeks, but months and years, cultivating each of those stages of that spiritual path as a firm foundation for the bodhicitta motivation. Okay? That's one of the two major techniques or trainings. The other training goes by another name. It's not called the six causes and one result. It's called the technique of exchanging self for others. Exchanging self and others. And one of the major sources of these teachings, though of course it all goes back to the Buddha, but one of the main textual sources where this exchange of self and other technique is presented is nothing other than Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. And in this technique, we're remembering the kindness of other beings, not only when they've been our mother. We don't have to think, oh, they've been our mother in the past, and think of all the kindness they give. In addition to that, we can think of the kindness of beings at all stages of our life, how much we depend on others. And then, on the basis of that kind of contemplation, we realize that working for our own benefit alone and leaving behind all the beings that we depend on is the height of selfishness. So we engage in a practice of exchanging self for others, which means exchanging an attitude in which we consider ourselves the most important of all and others secondary. We switch that attitude to recognize that these multitudinous beings who all wish to be happy and nobody and none of them wish to suffer, because there are so many of them, there's only one of me, that the focus is on working for the benefit of the many. So there's an exchanging self for others, and then there are practices which are indicated in the next section for bringing about that transformation. And then, of course, there are great masters such as Lama Tsongkhapa who took both methods, the six-point cause and effect meditation and the exchanging self for other meditation, and then combined them into one coherent practice. And you can, and that's very often taught as well. Sometimes these two practices are taught separately, and sometimes they're taught in an integrated fashion. Typically, at least based on the experiences I've had, the teacher exposes us to each of those two methods separately, you know, so you can really get a sense of what each of them was about and the scriptural context and so forth. And then we learn how to integrate them both because they both fit together. Okay. So I mention all this not because just mentioning the names is going to mean anything right now, but in the context of receiving further teachings, it's helpful to know how all of these subdivisions of the teachings integrate one to the other. Right? It can help us make sense out of other teachings that we receive. Okay. So, in the 7-point mind training, that second part, the main practice, is reminders, hints, instructions on how to cultivate the ultimate awakening mind, the wisdom, understanding the way things actually exist, and a working synonym for that, just for your interest, is how to cultivate the wisdom of emptiness, okay, of lack of inherent existence, and how to cultivate the conventional awakening mind. Okay. And then the following sections elaborate on these. The third subsection is changing adverse circumstances into the path. And I'm going to say a few words on this, and then we'll have a break, and then we'll come to the concluding hour. Okay? So after this, we'll have like a 5-minute break or something like that. Enough time to get a glass of water, use the facilities, and then we'll conclude with the last hour. Okay? So, the third one, changing adverse circumstances into the path. Actually, I'm not going to refer particularly to the four subheadings that I have in my outline or to what's in the other version you have, in under three. In the other version you just have a few lines, that's all. I'm just going to limit myself by saying in our everyday situation, we're always meeting circumstances that don't make us particularly happy. They're not conducive to spiritual practice. And sometimes when things are going badly, we might think, well, when I feel better, then I'll practice the Dharma. But right now, I've got a headache, you know, or things are difficult. That's a very, very easy excuse, a very easy attitude to arise. But that is quite problematic. One is because that means that during the parts of our life when things aren't going well, there's no possibility of progressing spiritually. Because we think it's adverse circumstances. But even worse than that is that those adverse circumstances themselves, if addressed properly, can become the perfect circumstances for developing the spiritual path. So we're not only missing out on the time that we could be meditating and contemplating and practicing, but we're missing out on the very subject matter, the very content, which if we could contemplate it properly and thoroughly, could actually propel our spiritual path rather than delay it. So, trying to think of just a very easy example of that. One very, very brief one. When I was younger, I used to suffer from headaches quite often and quite badly, right? And when they came up, it was a feeling of total, being totally debilitated, right? I couldn't do anything. I thought I couldn't do anything, right? And it was really wallowing in a real deep poor me mentality when these things arose. Okay. But it is possible to shift one's attention so that even when the pain is happening, even when the headache is happening, instead of becoming a barrier to a spiritual development, it actually becomes the fuel for it. And I'll give just two examples in relation to the headache. There's many other approaches that could help. One is, if we understand the teachings of karma, actions and the result, which was indicated earlier, if we fully understand it, when we're experiencing the pain of a headache, for example, we're beginning the process of exhausting the negative karma, which is the deep cause of having received the headache in the first place. Right? Because from the Buddha's point of view, any suffering we experience is not just due to the present condition, like I used to get headaches if the sun was too glaring, or if I ate the wrong food, that would be the condition for the headache. But that wasn't the cause of the headache. The deep cause of the headache was some negative action done in the past. So now, when I was experiencing the headache, I could view that pain as helping exhaust that negative karma. So even though it's painful, I don't want to be masochistic about it, but I could view it in a positive light. At least I'm getting rid of it. As long as I can get out of that poor me mentality, which just makes matters worse, then I could feel that I'm relinquishing the results or exhausting the results of that negative karma. There's more that can be said about that, but for the time being, that's just enough of that. But it goes beyond that as well as simply viewing the negative circumstances as an exhaustion of the negativity of the past. Sometimes if we're sick and the doctor prescribes a medicine, the medicine tastes disgusting, right? There's no one who likes that medicine. It's horrible. But you would take it gladly if you really felt this is going to cure my illness. Then even though you dislike it, you'll put up with it. You'll actually, in a sense, like it because you know it's going to work. You have faith that it's going to work, right? So in a sense, you can view suffering that way. But another way of viewing it is by recognizing the suffering that the headache is giving, one, you can begin the process of empathizing with the suffering of other beings who experience similar suffering and difficulty. In other words, instead of closing us off from others, it really opens us up into sympathy for others. You know, so I've always been able to feel sympathetic to people who have headaches because I have a history of that. But there are other diseases or problems other people have that I don't have full sympathy with because it's not part of my remembered history. Right? So suffering can open up the door to increased empathy and sympathy for the experience of others, and that heart-opening attitude is very, very, very much at the center of the Lojong mind training of cultivating the bodhicitta. Okay? So, because adverse circumstances arise, it's very good if we have methods for using them to propel the spiritual path as opposed to thinking, well, now that these adverse circumstances are preventing me from following the spiritual path. So it's a shift of attitude, turn something from a barrier to an actual method. Okay? And I think of all the various teachers that I've run across, and I've had many, many extraordinary teachers. It is Kabshi Sopa Rinpoche who is the most eloquent in talking about changing adverse circumstances into the path. It's something they all talk about, but if you look at the books that he's written and listen to the talks that he's given, you'll see that this becomes a major theme repeated many, many times in many different guises. And there is actually one of his books has the title. I don't remember exactly the words of the title, but it's basically something like changing adverse circumstances. Transforming problems. That's what it's called. Transforming problems. Yeah. So, our Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Okay. So why don't we take that break now? Good. It's 9 minutes before 3 on my clock in this time zone. So why don't we come back at 3 and then we'll continue until 4. Thank you. What I usually do is I ask whoever's here, you know, I say, If there are people who haven't yet returned, would you please raise your hand? So we just touched on the first, second, and third of the practices of the 7 point, or points, I guess we could say, the first, second, and third point of the 7 point mind training. And then the fourth one, elucidating a lifetime's practice, is what we're going to devote most of the rest of their hour together to, so I won't say anything about them right at the moment. And then the last two, the last three, is the measure of having trained one's mind, transformed one's thought. In other words, what we can notice within ourselves that gives us an idea of how well we've trained our mind in these practices. So that's the measure of having trained one's mind. Then the commitments of mind training, including what's to be accomplished and what's to be avoided, and then the instructions of mind training. And in the outline that of the little booklet that you've received, then I have almost nothing for the sixth and the seventh point here, but you see all these various lines of advice, kind of these aphorisms for number six, the commitments, and number seven, the instructions. And most of them require commentary to be understood, but at least it gives an idea that these are this is the individual subject matter. So it's like point pieces of advice, different, we could say, pithy sayings to focus our attention on the measure, the commitments, and the instructions. Okay? So having done a very, very brief overview of the 7 point training mind, now I want to focus on the fourth part, applying the five powers, or sometimes called the five forces, and that's on page 5, the last page. Okay? And this is for a second, just to go back to page 4, under number 4, where it's these two are described under the heading elucidating a lifetime's practice. In other words, it's the kinds of things that we practice during our lifetime, you know, moment to moment, day to day, you know, kind of practical advice, how to keep all these trainings alive and developed, and then especially the five forces to be applied at the critical juncture, just before the time of death. Okay? So it's how to make our life meaningful and how to enhance our movement from one life to another to ensure that we move in a safe, positive direction. Okay? So the names for the five that I'm going to use here is based on teachings by Kepje Sopa Rinpoche, and you'll see that names from 1 to 5 under A, before the time of death, and under B, near the time of death, they're the same names, right? The power of the white seed, the power of intention, which can also be called the power of determination or motivation, the power of blame, which can also be called the power of repudiation or destruction, the fourth one, the power of prayer, and the fifth one, the power of training or familiarity. The reason I'm giving these alternative titles to them is the same reason I gave before, is that you will read different commentaries, and not everyone translates each of these terms the same way. And these include all of the alternative translations that I've run across. Okay? So, you don't have it? Yes, please. Certainly.
Just like an overview question. If you are studying the 7-point mind training or the five powers, would this be, if you were studying in a monastery, if you were studying personally, would you be specializing in this for a certain period of time, or would you be doing this study in conjunction with five or six other things? You know, like if you're taking five courses in college, are you taking five courses and doing this, or are you doing this exclusively? I'm just curious how it works.
I don't know how authoritative an answer I can give, because I've never studied this within the context of the Tibetan monastic system, so I'm not really quite sure how it's presented. But a typical approach to the study of Dharma is one receives training in the Lamrim. You know, the Lamrim is the graded path of the teachings right from the beginning to the end. So, you know, one receives an ongoing training in the Lamrim, repeatedly, right? When I was a new student, I attended teachings that my teacher was giving at the library, and one of the hours, like in the 9 o'clock hour, he would give a Lamrim teaching, and it would extend over months. Maybe at the 12 o'clock hour, he'd give a Lamrim teaching, but he would complete it, in a couple of weeks. So he'd give longer and shorter versions, more extensive. So just getting really familiar with that whole Lamrim structure, right? And then at other hours or in other teachings, then you zone in and focus on a particular aspect that you find in the Lamrim. So one of them would be these Lojung teachings, right? So for that period of time, you may have been studying Lamrim in general, keeping that clear in the mind, and then at a certain point focusing on the Lojung teachings. And one of the pieces of advice I remember my teacher giving, he said, it was very, very helpful. There's different kinds of meditation, and one type of meditation which is very helpful, he called a glance meditation. And what that means is that you have available a very brief version of the Lamrim. And that could be the foundation of, what's it called? Foundation of all good qualities. That's a very brief Lamrim text. Or there's other outlines that you can have. So you have something like that available. You've either memorized it or you have it on a sheet of paper. And at the beginning of your meditation session, you just refresh your memory for the scope of the whole path by doing a glance meditation. So you're just basically reading through it, just familiarizing yourself with the outline. And it's relatively brief, right? And then, during the remainder of that meditation session, so that might occupy the first few minutes of the meditation session, then for the remainder of the meditation session, you focus in on one element of that Lamrim path, right? And you can change, like some people do it in a literal order, that's going to be how. You weren't here earlier, I don't think, when Don talked about a weekend retreat on the Lamrim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, in that, there's going to be over Thanksgiving, there's going to be a 3-day retreat on the Lamrim, in which they take all the Lamrim subjects and divide it among the meditation sessions spread over from Friday to Sunday. I think it is like that. And so there is an outline, right? And then they just go through the whole thing in progressive order. Other times, for other situations, you might familiarize yourself with the whole Lamrim outline, and then in that particular session, you meditate on the one aspect that really caught your attention that morning or that day. So you might not necessarily go in order 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You might just focus on whatever seemed to be particularly relevant to you on that moment. And both of those approaches have some value, though of course there's great value in doing it in the order as well. But even the other one, staying current to what's on your mind can be helpful. So basically there's that way of combining getting a sense of the overall structure, but then focusing at different times on elements of it, such as the Lojong teachings.
Right.
But it'll vary from teacher to teacher and situation to situation. Okay. So before the time of death means, you know, this is the ordinary living situation where death doesn't appear to be imminent, you know, so we're just living our life. So during that time, we apply these five forces, the power of the white seed and so forth, in the following way, okay? So I'll read what's printed here and then just try to give a little bit of explanation for each one. So the power of the white seed. By building up the two collections of merit and wisdom through such practices as offering, and by purifying one's obscurations, one is planting seeds of virtue, which will bring about an increase in one's bodhicitta. Okay, this makes reference to something I mentioned earlier. I made a comment, I forget whether it was today or yesterday, about how one lama mentioned now is the time not so much to meditate, but engage in collecting and cleansing practices. Do you remember some of you when I mentioned that? You know, preparing the mind for the ground of realizations by cleansing the mind of impurities and by collecting a store of virtuous energy. So that is very largely what's being referred to here under the title The Power of the White Seed. So we're completing the collection of meritorious energy and wisdom, you know, gaining insight into the nature of reality and in engaging in virtuous deeds, right? And then purifying one's obscurations through all the various purification practices there are, making prostrations, vajrasattva, there's quite a number of different purification practices, the recitation of the prostrations to the 35 Buddhas and so forth, right? To use the analogy I was using in the earlier class, all this is preparing the ground of our mind for cultivating realizations, and specifically for cultivating the realization of bodhicitta. So we're continually getting our mind ready and prepared for this realization. I use the expression to increase the nutrient level of our mind, you know, the fertilizer, the sunshine, the water that allows the crop to grow. By engaging in these practices, collecting merit and wisdom on one hand and purification on the other, we're preparing our mind, our heart, for gaining these realizations to bring about, as it says here, an increase in one's bodhicitta. Okay? And they call that the power of the white seed. I don't think I've ever received an explanation of why they call it white seed. I can guess at least the seed part of it is that by doing this, we're creating the causes which eventually will lead to our being able to develop or cultivate the bodhicitta motivation. So I think that's why it's called a seed. Why it's called a white seed, maybe white is just a symbol for something that's clean and pure and radiant. But that's my guess. Other than that, I don't know why they use that title. But is the meaning of it, the underlying meaning, you know, engaging in those collecting and cleansing practices that enable us to gain realizations, specifically the cultivation of bodhicitta, is that... Do you have an understanding of that? Is that clear enough? Okay. The second one is the power of intention, which in other translations is sometimes called the power of determination or the power of motivation. And here, it's cultivating the resolution not to let one's... You know, that's the first time in the week I've been here that I've actually seen the train. Because either it was at nighttime and I couldn't see anything, right? Or I heard it and didn't turn to look at it. Because I was told that I was so impressed that the stupa was built in such a fashion that you could see it from the road. And someone the other day said to me, he says, yeah, and the people in the train, when they pass by, they can see it as well. And I thought, the people in the train can see it as well? It was hard to believe. And they said, yeah, well, especially when there's not so many leaves on the tree, they can see from the tracks, they can see to the stupa. So finally I know what they were talking about. Okay. That's an example, by the way, a negative example of staying single-mindedly focused on the object of what I was supposed to be talking about. No distraction whatsoever. Okay. So here, to read from it, it says, cultivating the resolution not to let one's life become meaningless, make a strong determination to keep oneself from coming under the control of self-centeredness or self-cherishing. So this is, again, it's a power of intention. It's something that we repeat kind of over and over again, try to bring up to mindful awareness that in all situations we try to be on the guard for the arisal of this what Tabji Sopu Rinpoche often used to call the demon of self-cherishing or self-centeredness. In other words, this thought, this attitude, the self-cherishing or self-centeredness, is referring to an attitude which is the very opposite, the very opponent to the bodhicitta, concern for the welfare of others. Because when we're cultivating the bodhicitta, it's based on having deep, heartfelt regard for the welfare of other beings. So much so that it becomes the main focus of our attention. Whenever a situation comes up, we think, how can I use it to benefit others? Right? That's the cherishing others attitude. The complete opposite of that is whenever a situation arises, the thought, whenever we face a situation, the thought arises, how can I use this to benefit me? That's why it's exactly the polar opposite, right? So if the thought is just, what's in it for me, right? Or what, there was an expression that was popular for a while, looking out for number one. Is that, you ever familiar with that expression? I haven't heard it in a long time, but there was a while ago I heard that, looking out for number one. We're number one, right? So if that's the main approach when things arise in our life, this is exactly the opposite of what we want to cultivate. We want to cultivate in its place what's in it for others. How can this situation be used to benefit others? You know, how can I shift my attention from being concerned only for my own welfare to how can I be concerned for the welfare of others? Okay. And there's one thing I want to add here. I have mentioned it before, but I think it can never be repeated too many times. The negative attitude, the one we're trying to overcome, is often called the self-cherishing attitude. Here I've called it self-centeredness or self-cherishing. Okay? And some people think, well, shouldn't I cherish myself? I mean, the teachings say we should take care of ourselves, we should rest when we're tired. If we don't cherish ourselves, if we don't take care of ourselves, then, you know, we'll go to pot, you know, we won't eat properly, we won't protect ourselves from danger, and then we're no use to anybody. So isn't there a value in self-cherishing? Does that objection ever arise in your mind? And that's solely based on the fact of the word cherishing. Right? So here we have to understand it's being used in a rather specific way. Yes, we should take care of ourselves. And if taking care of ourselves means cherishing ourselves, yes, we should cherish ourselves. But that's not what it means here. Self-cherishing is an attitude in which we're not simply taking care of ourselves or looking out for ourselves. It's when we're pushing our own likes and dislikes, our own intentions, our own desires, we're pushing that in the foreground as if it were more important than the welfare of all other beings. So it's not just paying attention to oneself and working for one's welfare. It's working for one's welfare to the extent that it takes the first place and everything else is barely in second place. Okay? That's the self-cherishing attitude. And that's the demon of self-cherishing. That's the negative one. But of course, if we just use cherishing in a very broad sense, you know, and of course we should take care of ourselves. After all, we're a human being. We don't want to suffer, so we should take care of ourselves. But it shouldn't be the case that the welfare of this one person should outweigh the welfare of 7 billion other human beings and countless non-human beings. And it's when the concern for one outweighs the concern for everyone else, that's the demon of self-cherishing. That's the negative aspect of self-cherishing. Not just being friendly with oneself or taking care of oneself. Okay? That's an important thing to keep in mind. Because a lot of people, especially when they're new or haven't heard the teachings very much or haven't had a chance to digest it too much, there's a number of things that arise in the Buddhist teachings which can sound masochistic. Just to be truthful about it. The words can sound that way. And if a person has a tendency towards masochism, they can take it that way. Right? And so you have to be careful about that tendency. And Lama Yeshe used to address this all the time. He said a lot of Dharma students become paralyzed. You know, they interpret the teachings in such a way that they feel that they can't enjoy any pleasure. That if they eat a piece of chocolate, they feel guilty. Have you ever heard or read teachings by Lama Yeshe where he talks about that? He really criticizes the attitude, jokingly but incisively, that can arise in the mind of a new or unprepared student, where it's very, very easy to take an exaggerated approach to the teachings, which completely misses what the teachings are meant to imply. Okay. So the power of intention. So the intention to keep from coming under the influence of this self-cherishing attitude. Okay. The third one you'll see is related to that. I mean, they're all related, but the third one is closely related. It's called the power of blame, the power of repudiation, or the power of destruction. And here it says, recognizing that all the problems one experiences come from self-centeredness, come from self-cherishing attitude, put the blame for all these difficulties on the demon of self-cherishing and strike out at it whenever it appears. Now this is also something to, you know, like the second one was keeping that attention throughout our life. So this third one, the power of blame, is keeping this intention throughout our life. And this is specifically when anything happens that causes a difficulty, a problem of any type. When it arises, there is a very common tendency to blame it on some outer circumstance, you know. Why are you feeling so miserable today? Oh, the weather was bad. Why do you seem to be in such a bad mood today? Oh, my boss yelled at me. You know, whatever's going wrong, we have an answer for it. And the answer, by and large, unless we're very deeply steeped in Dharma practice, so it comes up as a matter of course, which requires a lot of training, the tendency is to blame it on something external to ourselves. The weather, the boss, the political climate, the economy, whatever it is. Okay? Whereas, from the point of view of these teachings, the only reason that we're encountering these problems is because we've indulged in the self-cherishing attitude in the past. And having indulged in these self-cherishing attitudes in the past, we've engaged in harmful behavior, and now we're reaping the karmic result of that negative karma. So instead of blaming the outward condition for the problem we're having, take the blame right to the deep cause of it, which is one's own self-cherishing attitude. So that's why it says the power of blame is to think, whenever a problem comes up, that was caused by my self-cherishing. Even if we don't immediately see the connection between the problem we're having now and self-cherishing, the attitude of self-cherishing that we've had in the past, even if we can't see the connection, just reminding ourselves that this is the case shifts our perspective. An example that's sometimes used for this is an echo. You think of a situation where maybe in some big, huge landscape where you can see for miles and you're at the end of a precipice and then you yell and then some seconds later a voice comes back to you, right? So let's say if you were in a lousy mood and you swore, you came up with a terrible insult or a swear word and you yelled that out, then a few seconds later that voice would come back to you, right? Well, let's say if you suffered temporary amnesia, then you might think that someone out there is insulting you because you forgot that you were the one who actually sent out that insulting energy to begin with. Well, in a sense, we all have this amnesia. We've created negative karma in the past under the influence of the demon of self-cherishing. We've put a negative energy out into the universe, and now when we're experiencing a difficulty, the echo effect is coming back to us. And it seems as if it's coming from outside of us, but in fact, the root cause was that we created the energy to begin with. Right? So it really changes our attitude tremendously if we take responsibility for the negative things that happen to us and recognize, not with a sense of guilt, not with a sense I'm a bad person, not like that, but just under the force of ignorance, just under the force of not knowing, under the force of habit, we've engaged in negative actions. We've not come out from under the force of a self-cherishing attitude, which is so powerful, right? And so now the problem that I'm experiencing is just that. So if I'm going to get angry at anyone, I should get angry at this negative attitude of my own mind. And since we can't do anything about the negative attitude that created the bad karma in the past, what we do is we use it to attack the self-cherishing that we still have at the moment. Right? We can't erase what we did in the past. We can just experience its result. But in all likelihood, we're still under the influence of some measure of self-cherishing, so we put the blame on that. So we in the second point, we watch for it to arise, you know, and we try to keep from coming under it. And in the third case, when we're experiencing suffering, we put the blame for that on the back of the self-cherishing attitude. So with this kind of constant reminder of how harmful the self-cherishing attitude is, there's a chance that we will not so easily come under its sway in the future. You know, we'll really be able to change our attitude and develop a real concern for the welfare of others, and we'll step back from pushing our own welfare in the front as if it were more important than everyone else's. At this point, I want to leave this just for a second, because there's a parallel teaching that's found in Shanti Devi. It's one of the more, maybe I could say, famous or well-known sections of Shantideva's text on the Bodhisattva's, cultivating the Bodhisattva's state of mind, following the Bodhisattva's way of life. It's in the sixth chapter on patience. And I'm sure a lot of people here have heard this one way or another, but it bears repeating because it's very parallel to what's here. And it's in the form of a dialogue. It's about how to deal with anger. And in this, a situation is described where a person is saying, I'm really angry at this person because he did something bad for me. He did something bad to me. And so my anger towards him is justified. I'm the victim of his cruelty, of his harm. So that's what the person is saying. So then Shantideva responds to him and says, if a person hits you with a stick, do you get angry at the stick? So the person thinks over that question for a while and says, no, I don't get angry at the stick. I get angry at the person who's manipulating the stick. The stick didn't hit me by itself, right? But I'm perfectly justified for getting angry at the man, let's say, at the man who hit me with the stick. Okay? And then Shantideva replies to that objection. He says, well, if it's wrong to get angry at the stick because the stick was merely manipulated by the man, then it's equally mistaken to get wrong at the man because the man is merely manipulated by his delusions. So if you're going to get angry at anything, get angry at the delusions, which of course has the subtext of not just getting angry at other people's delusions, but delusions aren't anybody's private property, and, you know, become suspicious and upset with your own anger, like that. So that's very similar, it's very parallel to this, you know, that when a difficult situation arises, recognize that it's the reason it arose in the first place was that at some point we were being manipulated by our self-cherishing attitude. And if we don't like the results, then don't like the self-cherishing attitude. You know, be wary of it. Try not to fall under its influence. Try to apply an antidote to it. Try not to buy into it. So that's the main point that seems to be being made here in these sections 2 and 3. Okay? Yes, please.
Didn't Shantideva say something about maybe his own harm might be partially to blame here? After all, that's what hurts.
Oh, I think there's something in Shantideva's teachings where he's saying, if we didn't have such a sensitive body, then being beaten wouldn't hurt us as much. I'm not sure. I don't remember the teachings well enough. So it may be the fact that we're responsible for having the kind of body that can be hurt by a beating. If we had a body of light, then it wouldn't matter, right? So again, it comes back to the point, why do we have the kind of body that can be hurt? Again, that also eventually comes back to the self-cherishing attitude. Yeah, that could be. I don't remember exactly if that's in Shantideva's as well.
I keep remembering it, but they can't pinpoint where it came from.
Yeah, I know that feeling. Okay, so now the fourth one, the power of prayer. And this is quite simple. It says, dedicate the virtuous activities of every day towards increasing one's bodhicitta. So here, you know, before we're talking about recognizing when something bad happens to us or a negative attitude arises and so forth. Here in the fourth one, we're shifting it to recognizing that during the course of the day, there are things that we do that are positive. You know, and of course, this includes the things that we do with a very specific intention to be positive, you know, where we make it part of our daily practice, you know, the way we're being. And it also includes things which arise kind of spontaneously, but which in retrospect in retrospect, are positive. Right? But it's especially these intentional actions, these so-called virtuous actions. So we become aware not just of the negative aspects of our being, that's kind of defeating just to focus on that. It's also not completely realistic because we have the Buddha nature. So we're going to be engaging in virtuous actions. So again, whenever we engage in a virtuous action, to derive the maximum benefit from it depends on the dedication that we make. So as that action is coming to an end, as we recall that action, then we think any virtuous merit created by that virtuous action, may it go towards increasing the strength of my bodhicitta. And of course, you can phrase that in different ways. You know, may it increase my love and compassion for all sentient beings, may it decrease my self-cherishing, may it increase my concern for the welfare of others. But here it's just, say, to increase one's bodhicitta, like that. So again, it's a mindfulness practice to take advantage. Some of the practices take advantage of the difficult situations we face, the untoward situations we face, how to deal with those, but some take advantage of the positive things that we experience, because our life is a mixture. But in both cases, whether it's positive or negative, we tie it with our mindfulness to the bodhicitta motivation, decreasing the self-cherishing, increasing our concern for the welfare of others, like that. And so it's called a prayer, because we could phrase it if we wish. You know, this can be done without words, but if we did it with words, it could be a statement that begins with, may I? You know? So as the result of this virtuous action, may I be able to cultivate the bodhicitta? And I used earlier today an example, which is, this isn't something I made up, but I heard from my teachers, where when we're engaged in an activity that gives benefit to others, even if it's limited benefit, I think I used the example of feeding pigeons or feeding birds or something like that. So we're not enlightening those birds, but we are giving them something that they want, you know, something that they're hungry for. So what we can do in those cases is tie it together with the bodhicitta motivation by just thinking, just as now I'm giving food to these birds, so in the future may I be able to lead all beings along the spiritual path to enlightenment. Or words to that effect, whatever words touch your own mind, you know? Like, now I'm giving food, in the future may I give Dharma. Like that. And this is incredibly powerful. You know, it's not just words. It really starts putting our mind on a track so that we can begin to emulate someone like Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who, if you observe him for a period of time, in good situations and in bad situations alike, he's continually dedicating the actions of his body, speech, and mind to the welfare of others. Continually. 24 hours a day. It's amazing. And we think, wow, what an amazing being. How did he become that way? Well, I can only think he became that way by training like this. You know? Like that. Really, really, really amazing. You know, it sometimes happens that being with Lama Zopa Rinpoche, especially if you have to organize things, can be a bit frustrating, because his sense of time has nothing to do with any of the time zones on this planet. You know, it's his own sense of time, right? It's really amazing when things start at their scheduled time, for example. And you can think, oh, he's just not paying attention to the clock, or he's disregarding that, or some people who don't know him, I think, oh, he's being selfish, he's keeping people waiting. There's all kinds of mistaken views that come up until you actually spend time with him and are with him where he's coming from and together with him on his way to where he's going. And what you discover is that on that journey, if he passes any being, human, animal, insect, doesn't matter what it is, who needs help, he gives it. Has anyone here seen that? Have you had enough exposure to Lama Zopa to see that happen? He'll be driving along from his house to the venue where he's supposed to give teaching, and on the way there'll be an animal that was struck by a car on the side of the road, and he'll go right then and do a puja to transfer that animal's consciousness to Pure Land Rebirth. Right there and then. No questions asked. And so he's constantly going from one situation that calls forth his compassion to the next. And so the end result is that sometimes that means that one schedule that people think he's on gets delayed. Right? It has nothing to do with selfishness. It has nothing to do with disregard for the welfare of others. It has to do with the extraordinary strength of his bodhicitta. You know? That's continually active. Okay? Of course, in our case, we have to be reasonable as well. You know? But that's often the reason why there's delays, is because something has come up that was more vitally important. And then, you know, the guru pays attention to that. And then the fifth one is the power of training or familiarity. Habituate one's mind to the training in bodhicitta during whatever activities one is performing. So this isn't completely separate from what was said before. It's another way of kind of summarizing that practice, but it's that familiarity, the repetitiveness of the training of it. So we're not just doing it every once in a while, but it becomes a really significant aspect of our being. Okay? So now, this gives an overview of how to apply the five powers in general as we're living our life. But then when we reach this critical juncture where this life is coming to an end, and what's important is to try to create the most conducive atmosphere so our journey into the next state of existence will be as positive as possible. You know, to be able to practice the Dharma, to meet the teachings, to engage in the practices, and so forth. Okay? So we apply these five forces, but in a modified form. They have the same name, but now they're very specific to the time of death. So, when it comes to the power of the white seed, the first one, the way it is modified is that one of the biggest obstacles to being able to make a successful transition from this life into the next, hopefully better life in the future, is attachment to the possessions of this life. That we can't let go of them. There's a story I heard for the first time from my teacher Geshe Ngawang Dargye, and since then I've heard it from a number of other teachers. So it seems like a favorite story, and it's about a practitioner. He's quite a good practitioner, and he had a special practice of how to transfer his consciousness to the Pure Land of Amitabha when he died. It's called a Poa practice. So he was quite proficient in this practice. But when he actually came time that his death was approaching, he found that he couldn't do it. He couldn't transfer his consciousness to Amitabha's Pure Land. Well, his guru, because of their kind of psychic connection, knew exactly what was happening to his disciple, and he recognized that the reason he was having so much trouble transferring his consciousness to Amitabha's Pure Land was that he was attached to the butter in his butter tea. You know, for Tibetans, tea is made with salt and butter, so it's more like soup than tea. It's got tea in it as well, but it has other things in it that we would never think of putting in tea, but that's the Tibetan style, right? And so this particular monk was attached to the butter in his butter tea, right? And because of that attachment, even though he was proficient at the Powa practice of transferring consciousness, he couldn't do it. So his guru sent him a psychic message, and the message was, there's much better butter tea in Amitabha's Pure Land. And as soon as he got that message, his Powa was successful, and he made it to Amitabha's Pure Land. Like that. So that's an example that the attachment to the things of this lifetime can be a big hindrance to progressing and in the desirable fashion. And so the power of the white seed here becomes, before, if we look back at before the time of death, the power of the white seed was planting the seeds of virtues so you can develop bodhicitta in the future. Here it's specifically how to make this transfer to the next lifetime. And the practice comes overcoming one's attachment to possessions by giving them away as offerings. So before one dies, it's a very excellent practice to give away those things one's attached to, so you no longer think of them as being yours, right? And then when you pass away, you'll have relinquished, depending on how well you do it, of course, then you will have relinquished attachment to those objects, and you can let go. Okay? The next one, the power of intention. Resolve not to become separated from bodhicitta while dying, in the intermediate state or making contact with one's future life. So when one's dying, one is entering into what we can think of as a threefold transition. There's the dying process itself. There's the intermediate state or bardo between one state of existence and the next. And then there is the future existence. So in one's mind, one keeps present the motivation, the intention, the determination to practice bodhicitta, to keep that bodhicitta intention, that compassionate attitude for the welfare of others, to keep it present in all three phases, the dying, the bardo, and the rebirth phase. Okay? Then, three, the power of blame. Okay? At the time of death, declare one's non-virtuous actions and retake one's broken vows. So here we try to die with as clean a slate as possible. So one way of doing that is just to declare or confess or reveal any negative actions that we have done that we've kind of kept hidden, that we haven't purified yet. Just to open up to them, and that begins the process of purifying them. So if there's a negative action that we've done, then engage in the various opponent powers that help us purify from that practice. And then for those people who have taken certain vows, whether they're the pratimoksha vows or the bodhicitta vows or the tantric vows, then there are ways specifically of purifying those vows. And one way, if you've taken the higher tantric vows, one of the ways of purifying any degeneration of those vows is to take that initiation again or do what's known as a self-initiation practice. So for the sake of his disciples, for example, when Lama Yeshe was about to pass away in California 31 years ago, his guru, Song Rinpoche, was flown over from where he was. I think he was in India at the time, I'm not sure. And one of the things that Tsong Rinpoche did was confer upon him the initiation that he had received before. Now, from Lama Yeshe's own side, I don't think there's any need to purify, but for the sake of his disciples, he underwent that purification by doing self-initiation and receiving the initiations again from the past. So that process is one way of overcoming those hindrances, those decline in one's samaya or commitments like that. And then fourth, the power of prayer is to take upon oneself all the suffering of others. And this, just a few words, but extremely profound, because in many cases, not all, but in many cases, the dying process is painful. There's a great variety of ways to die. There's some people who die very, very peaceful, pain-free deaths, and there's many people who die a process which is filled with pain, physical pain, confusion, mental pain, anguish. You've probably heard stories about people who have had, who have experienced that in the dying process. So, there you are, you're dying. You're not particularly happy to be dying. There's some pain, mental or physical or emotional, involved in it. At that moment, if you have the presence of mind to think, may my experience of this pain, anguish, suffering, if it was sufficient to exhaust the negative karma of other beings, may that be so. In other words, instead of shying away from my difficulty and thinking, oh, I was hoping to have a peaceful death, a painless death, but darn it, here it is, I'm dying, and it's not a bed of roses, it's really difficult. Instead of thinking that way and then bewailing oneself or getting upset with it, say, okay, I'm experiencing pain now. That's true, that's an honest assessment. I'm experiencing some form of pain, anguish, right? May it be sufficient to exhaust the suffering of others. And that immediately turns the whole situation around. Before, the pain and suffering was this heavy burden preventing us from doing what we had always hoped we could do, transition to the future in a good, open, clear, radiant state of mind. And instead, something quite the opposite has come up. Instead of viewing that, experiencing that as a major, major hindrance and obstacle, we decide, I'm going to use that. And we use it by allowing us to contact and remember the suffering of other beings. That immediately frees us from the trap of the self-cherishing attitude. Before it was a prison, now it opens it up immediately. It's really alchemical in its ability to transform situations radically.
Is this kind of an expansion or an addition to the Tonglen practice?
It's exactly part of the Tonglen practice.
Okay.
The more that phrase Tonglen may be unfamiliar to some people here, it's the practice of taking away the suffering of others to destroy one's own self-cherishing attitude and giving them happiness. And there's many, many applications of this practice, but if we build up enough familiarity with this Tonglen or giving or taking practice during our life, then even at the time of death, even when we're experiencing difficulties which may arise, because it often does, that may arise at the time of death, instead of relating to that as a major obstacle, we just make it part of our Tonglen practice. A very, very powerful way of using Tonglen. Yeah. Okay. And then finally, the power of training or familiarity. Having thoroughly habituated one's mind to bodhicitta, transfer one's consciousness by the force of this mind training while meditating on bodhicitta and then it's added in the lion posture. That phrase at the end, in the lion posture, describes the attitude in, or the posture, the attitude in which Buddha himself passed away, lying on his right side. There are different postures of passing away. There have been teachers who have passed away sitting in full lotus position. But also one way of passing away that's helpful is the same posture which is helpful when we're going to sleep, and that is lying on our right side. That done in, you know, with familiarity, it's a way of keeping the mind clear and focused so we can engage in the spiritual practices. So the power of training, then, having thoroughly habituated one's mind to bodhicitta, then transfer one consciousness, in other words, aim it towards, for example, rebirth in a pure land, such as Amitabha's, or a human rebirth which has all the facilities for us to follow, continue following the spiritual path and meet teachers while meditating on bodhicitta. Okay. So, that brings this so-called retreat to an end. So, thank you for coming, especially for the opportunity to revisit these teachings. Because even though I have been for a number of years in the position of studying and listening to these teachings, and even on some occasions giving these teachings, to be perfectly honest, except when I am forced to really think about these teachings, which I'm forced to do when I have to present it to someone else, often they don't arise in my mind spontaneously. Right? I'm thinking about something else. And though something else isn't worth repeating what they are. Okay? So I really cherish the opportunity to have to get deeper into the teachings by being forced to pay attention to them in the way I have to pay attention to them, to present them in a halfway decent manner to someone else. And this relates to the fact that my own meditation practices is not very, very good, really. And I'm not being modest here, it's just true. When I'm left to myself, time passes and then the session's over, and that's all I've done is pass the time. But when I have to lead a meditation for others, that's when something happens. So it's related to that. So having to teach, having to lead something, for me, it may be a little bit beneficial to other people, but for me personally it's very beneficial. So I thank you for providing that circumstance. And I it may sound like I'm speaking from a position of modesty or something like that, but every word of what I just said is absolutely true. So I'm very, very grateful. And so now we've reached the conclusion, and there is the meditation, the dedication that I gave earlier today, and I know Donna liked that one particularly, but I've also heard that in these teachings, very often it's been the dedication chapter of Shantideva that's been recited. Now, if you don't feel it takes too much time, do we have time to do it? That might be.
What we normally do is just it's about 10 or 12 stanzas.
Oh, that's not too long.
Yeah, that are on page 246 and 247.
Okay, so if you have that copy,
prayer book.
Right. So this is at the very end of that text by Shantideva that I've made reference to, you know, the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, and the last chapter in it is this extensive, very beautiful poetic dedication, and it contains verses that His Holiness the Dalai Lama recites every single day of his life. Especially the very, very last one, we reach it. Some of you may recognize it from teachings by the Dalai Lama. Oh, here, I didn't even read this. It says, the following is one of His Holiness the Dalai Lama's favorite dedications. Right? So I wasn't lying. I didn't know it said that there until just now. Okay. So whatever positive energy has been generated, even by gaining a slight intellectual understanding of the teachings, much less an experiential understanding of them, may be dedicated following the example of Shanti Deva's beautiful dedication. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid. May those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. One of the presentations I'm going to make later in this week, at the moment I've forgotten which day it is, but is a presentation of pilgrimage. And one of the sites that we visit is the monastery, Nalanda Monastery, the ruins of that monastery, where Shanti Deva lived and composed this text. And one of the experiences of deepest joy I've had in this life was going to the grounds of that monastery with a copy of Shanti Deva and reading the dedication chapter at the site where he actually composed it. It was one of those experiences which is truly eternal, in other words, outside of time. It wasn't as if all those centuries had passed. It was a very, very, very powerful experience of making that connection. So, do you know where Bodh Gaya is? It's just north of there, just a short distance, called Nalanda. Yeah. Okay. So thank you, everybody.